Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very first in-depth interview podcast for our new year. As you're about to hear, we're blaming this all on Del Leonard, a longtime listener of the Peter B. Collins Show and our podcasts, who is based in New England in Maine. He suggested the topic and actually sent me the book for this interview, as you'll hear in just a moment. And Del's level of dedication is something I really value. And if you value the work that I do here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast, I invite you to become a subscriber if you're not already. All you got to do is go to peterbcollins.com. In the upper right corner, you click the tab that says Menu, and next you click on Become a Subscriber. It's easy. From there, you get a choice of $5, $10, $20 a month or $50 annual subscription. We've also got the new app for Android phones available at Spreaker and Spreaker.com. And you can buy yourself for $3, actually $2.99, the Peter B. Collins app at the Apple application store for iPhones and iPads. I'm glad you're listening, and I'd like to be glad for your support, too. Today on the Peter B. Collins Podcast, we're going to talk with retired Professor Ken Geiser about his new book, Chemicals Without Harm. And it's all Del Leonard's fault. This is Del and his a cappella group.
Gonna find my baby, gonna hold her tight, gonna grab some afternoon delight. My motto's always been, when it's right, why wait until the middle of a cold, dark night?
Del Leonard is a Renaissance man who has volunteered as the director of marketing for the Peter B. Collins Show since way back, I think, about 2007. He resides on the coast in Maine, and he is a workplace safety inspector. And a couple of months back, he sent me a care package. He renewed his annual subscription to the Peter B. Collins Podcast, and he sent a box of books that got waylaid at the Mill Valley Post Office for almost a month. And when I finally got them, I opened up, and in it was a copy of Ken Geiser's new book, Chemicals Without Harm, Policies for a Sustainable World. And in the note that was included, Del wrote that Chemicals Without Harm is fresh off the press, written by my University of Massachusetts Lowell professor, Dr. Ken Geiser. Geiser has a farm in Buckfield, not too far from where Del lives in Waterford, Maine, and he suggests that an interview with Ken would complement my interview last December with Dr. John Warner. John Warner is one of the fathers of the green chemistry movement, a former Polaroid researcher, and we had a delightful conversation with him that you can find on my website, December of 2014. That is a long introduction, Dr. Ken Geiser, but welcome to the Peter B. Collins Podcast, and the network is working.
Thank you, Peter. It's great to be with you, and what a nice connection there to Del and his fine work.
Now, tell us a little bit about this guy. I've never actually met Del Leonard. We've been corresponding for years, and I have a very rosy impression of him. Can you bring him down to earth a little bit?
Del is a remarkable man, a very solitary and serious and just a gentle soul. He traveled from Maine, nearly to 3-hour drive, twice a week to take classes down at the university. He got his degree in industrial hygiene, went back to Maine, and he's been a great advocate for worker safety in Maine, working in the electronics industry, working in, I think, some of the paper mills, and most recently, I think he's got a position at the Naval Shipyard.
Mm-hmm.
So he's an all-round great advocate.
Well, he certainly is. And I'm delighted to talk with you today. And as I mentioned, Dr. John Warner was my real first introduction to even the concept of green chemistry. So you're a professor, and your book is quite detailed and rich with a lot of information, a lot of different perspectives. And the bottom line is that our culture and our economy are deeply intertwined with the use of chemicals, synthetic chemicals, and various compounds that have been developed, since 100-150 years ago. And they make our lives better. As I mentioned to you before we started recording, I can't count how many chemicals I've already used today to make me look pretty and smell good and whatever else has contributed to, the first part of my day. So we're deeply dependent on these substances. And at the same time, we're well aware of many of the side effects, many of the toxic consequences of the use of chemicals. So give us the elevator pitch here, if you would, on what your vision is for green chemistry, Ken Geiser.
Sure. You kind of lay out the problem pretty well that I try to address in the book, Peter. It is certainly an irony that the tremendous benefits that we get from the chemical revolution that has produced so many really effective and low-cost chemicals that we make so many of our products and our workplace productivity out of, too many of them turn out to have hazardous attributes to them, hazardous conditions that may range from chronic illnesses and acute hazards to physical hazards, often in small doses, but over time, small doses add up, and we now see that a lot of us, Americans here in an industrialized country like ours, but also people throughout the world now carry residues of those chemicals in their bodily fluids. And we don't know what the potential health effects may be. Science takes a long time to make those kind of relational or causal connections. But we do know that some of those chemicals, those hazardous chemicals, can be replaced. And there's a precautionary thought here that what we should do is, if we know that chemicals do cause cancer or reproductive hazards or neurological damage, we shouldn't be using them if there's substitutes that can do the job just as well. And so the book is really trying to be a search for how we can move to a safer system of chemicals. What would it take from government? What does it take from industry? What does it take from the consumer? And particularly, what does it take from science?
Mm-hmm. Your very first line in the book references Dr. John Warner, and it certainly got my attention. You say he sits in a light-filled office in a nondescript suburban office park north of Boston, and he'll tell you that 60% of the chemicals on the market are dangerous and have no safer alternative as a substitute. And I mentioned that John Warner, his background was in doing some of the pure research that was funded by the Polaroid Corporation. We had the Bell Labs years ago, where AT&T had this monopoly, and as part of the grand bargain, if you can call it that, they did research whether it was leading to a product that they could profit from or not. And I would argue that one of the biggest problems we face is that corporate America, with its eye on the next quarterly returns statements, has stopped investing in pure research. And so the very companies that could profit from the development of green chemicals don't bother to do so because they're too busy extracting profits from the current batch of chemicals that they process and market.
This is true and sad. It's, what has happened as we've shifted from a form of capitalism and industrial capitalism, where basically, with the traditional model of investing in corporations, to a form of capitalism that's now much more financial capitalism, in which the investment is really in speculating on prices of value of corporations. And that has driven a very short-term orientation toward profiting and demanded that companies cut costs significantly. significantly and produce efficiencies that are often pretty tragic. The cutting of costs, of course, has meant the cutting of research, cutting of future development. And that's certainly what we've seen in the chemical industry. American chemical industry at one point, say the 1920s or 30s, had huge labs that were doing really important production chemical products like nylon, came out of DuPont's work from those labs, Tyvek, Naugahyde, various products that became standard. Today, the chemical industry is cut back significantly on research, does very little in-house research.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's not the capacity to really develop greener and safer chemicals that there once was.
And I haven't read the documents about the merger or the takeover. I'm not sure who's on top, Dow and DuPont. But they will be merged into what they hope will be the number two worldwide chemical global leader. And I can't imagine that in the documents that spell out how this is going to profit the investors, that there's a paragraph devoted to pure research. And that, yeah, you know, by combining these two companies, we'll have the wherewithal, the capital resources, to invest in these 10 research and development programs that could clean up some of the messes that we have profited from in our legacy development years.
Well, that certainly would be a optimistic view of this merger. My understanding is that the effort is really to redesign these two firms to basically merge the two significant administrative units and all, but then to break it up into some divisions, much like we saw with Monsanto several years ago, that basically spun off its chemical divisions, and I think that's what we're going to see here as well, which not necessarily going to mean there's a lot of focus on research and development.
And, Professor, in your book, you give us a quick overview of the U.S. chemical industry. Large and profitable in the U.S., it's a $720 billion annual enterprise generating 70,000 products, 12% of the nation's manufacturing revenue. There are 13,500 chemical manufacturing facilities in the U.S., owned by more than 9,000 companies, employing about 800,000. And since the 90s, production's been growing at about 4% per year. And this is, I think, noteworthy. The bulk chemical production, you note, is largely located in Texas, Louisiana, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and California. And you describe the specialty chemical industry as widely dispersed. So that gives us a thumbnail of the U.S. chemical industry. To what extent do you believe that, particularly as the mergers have made bigger companies, is the federal government and our state governments equipped to properly regulate the chemical industries and their facilities?
Well, we have a good history on this. In the 1970s, the federal government stepped in with a series of rather far-reaching environmental statutes, things like the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, all of which attempted to focus on regulation of chemicals in media, in air, in water, in drinking water, of course, OSHA, in workplaces. These were very pioneering laws. These were kind of model laws that were emulated in countries throughout the world. And during the first decade or two that followed those, we were seen as really the leader in this area. However, after the 1980s, when the administration changed, there was a great slowdown in the
industry. You can mention the name Ronald Reagan. It's okay.
I can mention it.
Yes.
I was kind of leaving people guessing, but yeah, it certainly was the Reagan presidency that shifted a lot of this, and that was the intention of the administration when they came in. They saw businesses overregulated and government was too big, and Ronald Reagan and his staff made efforts to really cut back on things like OSHA and EPA and other regulatory agencies. And that has pretty much persisted since. The Congress has been generally in the hands of fairly conservative parties.
Well, let's call them pro-business, because right. It's not just conservatism, because, you know, true conservatism would be wanting to conserve our natural resources, protect the environment, and those sorts of things. This is not conservatism. This is bought and paid for slavish devotion to the patrons who pay for the campaigns of the people who get elected. And so this is part and parcel of our open bribery scheme that we call campaign finance in this country. And it is working for corporate America, because they have managed to take safety regulations and all of the developments from the EPA that Richard Nixon signed into law back in 1970, and turn it on its ear. And regulations that are designed to protect the health and safety of average people or those in a workplace are now described as job killers. And Carly Fiorina, who ran HP, and you reference HP and praise some of their work on controlling resources and the use of all the packaging that they put into circulation. But she's now running for president, and she describes any regulation as anathema and, you know, uses this job killer label to describe anybody who wants a reasonable balance between, you know, the freedom of a company to innovate and the need to protect people from the side effects of chemicals in particular.
Yes, of course, you're right. It is a business orientation that has taken over, and that's, as I mentioned earlier, the sort of orientation that comes from a highly speculative market. In regards to Ms. Fiorina, yes, she was actually, of course, pushed out of HP has taken a very business-friendly, I think she was pretty business-friendly to begin with, orientation. But the point is that it's not necessarily the leadership of these corporations. It's often the management structure that has been experimenting with looking at safer chemicals. And we do see that some brand name firms, noting the rise in consumer awareness about hazardous chemicals in products, are trying to pay more attention to shifting towards safer chemicals. And this is a shift that is going on here in the United States, going on in Europe as well.
And that's, I think, an important component here that I'd like listeners to understand and get that message from your book. Because consumer activism has really changed, you know, the course of business in many respects. And it's one of the few areas where we see a kind of responsiveness to a greener approach. And I'd like you to go into a little more detail about some of the consumer actions. And in particular, you point out a big gap in regulation in the United States related to cosmetics, where the European Union is much more advanced in recognizing the long-term impact of the use of untested cosmetics on human beings.
Yes, as I mentioned, after 1980, really the U.S. kind of slowed down in both its regulatory and its federal policies on chemicals, and that didn't occur in Europe. And Europe moved forward with increasingly innovative policies, most recently in the last decade, really in 2006. The European Union basically overhauled all of its chemical policies in one major new statute called REACH. Under REACH, all chemicals in the European Union have to be registered, and those of most concern would need to have government authorization for continued use.
And if I can interrupt just on behalf of Carly Fiorina, that's been a big job killer in Europe, right?
It certainly has not been a job killer. It's not a job killer. The literature on regulations do not support the argument that this kills jobs. What tends to kill jobs is corporations moving to lower income countries for production and walking away from, in our case, American workers.
And not only lower costs, but lower regulatory standards. And some of these trade deals, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and its predecessors, NAFTA, the WTO, threaten to lower the standards in the United States by essentially, you know, normalizing things to the lowest possible regulatory standards on a global basis.
Yep, that's true. It's interesting, though, that what the Europeans have done has raised the bar with REACH and raised the standards for chemicals globally. And what we're seeing is interesting here, Peter, is that countries in Asia and Southeast Asia, like China and Korea and Taiwan and all, have put in place new policies to harmonize with the REACH standards, the REACH regulations. They aren't necessarily any more innovative than REACH, but they are basically trying to cope with the Europe, which is the largest market for chemical products, and to make sure that their firms are competitive in there. And so while the U.S. has lagged, this interesting axis between Europe and Asia is driving more regulated consumer or regulated chemicals market.
So, Professor, in your chapter about transforming the chemical industry, you talk a little bit about attempts at self-regulation, and you ultimately conclude basically self-regulation can't achieve optimal outcomes without external pressures from customers, standard-setting organizations, non-government advocates, investors, or the threat of government intervention. And as I read this, I certainly agree with your comment here, but I think you're being a little too polite. And I'll just put a little context around it. I read this part of your book shortly after I saw the new movie about the mortgage meltdown in 2008 called The Big Short. And self-regulation didn't work so well on Wall Street. And I think that it simply is a failed concept that is promoted by industry along with the false meme about job killing. And this is all an attempt just to extract greater profits at higher risk to communities and individuals.
Well, I would maybe slightly disagree with that. There is certain parts of self-regulation, and certainly the self-regulation we saw on Wall Street did not even exist. But where it's a, maybe it's not quite the right word here, where brand name companies, and here Nike or Dell or HP or Apple or whatever, are competing for a market that is increasingly sensitive to chemical constituents in products, they tend to compete a bit to try to make sure that they are producing the safer chemicals in their brand area. And so you could call it self-regulation. I did only in one place call it self-regulation, but it is a kind of self-regulation in which firms are actually trying to move towards safer chemicals because of the consumer demand. And indeed, in this case, consumer demand more than government regulation is really the driver for firms actually moving this direction.
Well, I do understand that, and I don't dismiss it. At the same time, I think there's a lot of greenwashing that goes on, where the marketing budgets that highlight these initiatives that you describe are much greater than the investment in the initiatives. And this is designed to persuade me, you know, that Apple is a good corporate citizen when it's the biggest tax dodger in the United States, and the conditions under which my iPhone, iPad, and Mac were made at a Foxconn factory in China are beneath deplorable. And the exposure of those workers to toxic substances as they build my beautiful Apple toys is something that, you know, is a clear double standard by companies that promote their green initiatives to American consumers.
All of that is true. I'm just sort of trying to say, look, there is some movement in industry, particularly at the product level, and that is putting pressure on the chemical industry. It can't work, as I said in that sentence you read, it really can't work except for outside pressure on the companies themselves. That can be government regulations. It can be this global regulation system that is happening because of Europe's initiative. It can be because of consumer drives. It can be because of retailers' drives. We're finding firms like Walmart and Target and others setting up restricted substance lists, chemicals that they will not have in their products. And what's interesting about that, consumers actually don't really have a way to know that that is happening. It's happening pretty much as a competitive process amongst corporations. Now, I don't want to over-exaggerate that because it is only really as good as the attention to chemicals of high concern would allow it to be. But there is some drive there. What I've tried to do is also note some of the drives that are coming from science, and that's where John Warner comes in, as chemists like John Warner and others are beginning a real process of developing and putting onto the market chemicals that are alternatives to some of the more worrisome chemicals. So it's many different factors that are driving. Now, it would be nice if our federal government were also one of those big drivers, and it's not.
Let me interject here, because I think one of the important takeaways that I got from your book is essentially, in your polite professorial way, you call bullshit on the congressional efforts to water down regulation by shifting to cost-benefit analysis. Take a moment here to describe risk analysis, cost-benefit, and the previous standard of unreasonable risk, because these are all important benchmarks that are used to, in my view, limit the amount of honest regulation that is applied to critical industries.
Sure, and that is, you've got it there. So it comes from the question of why a listener of yours might have this question: why do chemical companies or product manufacturers basically put hazardous chemicals into products, even knowing that they are hazardous? And they do it because they have a way of muting the kind of concern that might be there, and that is a set of tools: risk assessment, cost-benefit assessment. Risk assessment is a way of deciding that the actual exposure to a hazardous chemical is small enough that the likelihood of a health outcome, a negative health outcome, is so small that it could be considered acceptable, as it's called, acceptable risk. Cost-benefit analysis, another tool which you mentioned, is one in which an analysis is made to determine whether the costs of reducing or eliminating a hazardous chemical are worth the value, the benefit that can be gotten from the chemical's function in a product. These are tools that have allowed industry to feel, and to not just feel, but to legally argue that they are not creating hazards that are unacceptable. And what it has done is it's blunted innovation. It has simply meant that the message that consumers have, which is they don't want products, they don't want products that contain hazardous chemicals to be on the market, that message doesn't get heard by the industry, because they can say, look, we do our risk assessment, we do our cost-benefit assessment, you shouldn't be worried. It's a very, very unlikely possibility that there would be a negative health consequence. And so what I try to argue against in the book is that kind of deadening kind of assessment. What I'm suggesting instead is that if something called alternatives assessment, which is if we know that there are safer chemicals and that they are as functional and all, or we can develop them through green chemistry and all, we should use them. It doesn't have to do with deciding what a safe level is. We should be always driving towards safer levels.
Professor, you also examine the impact of these kinds of facilities on the communities where they're located. And you zero in on the Shell Chemicals petrochemical plant in Norco, Louisiana, which is hard by a residential area called Diamond. And the residents there have reported, pretty high levels of illness and ailments that can be linked to the facility itself. And I would also add in the town of Richmond, California, which is just across the bridge from me here. And it is captive to the big oil company Chevron. And Chevron last year tried to essentially buy the city council by spending millions of dollars running its own slate of candidates. and the impoverished community smelled a rat, and they rejected it, entirely, and elected a slate of people who are willing to challenge Chevron, the big multinational oil company. Take us to Norco, and do you find Shell to be a responsible operator of that facility?
Well, I can't speak directly to Norco. I use that as an example because of the it shows how a big chemical plant can affect local communities. There's a whole area along the Mississippi there that extends down through to New Orleans. It's actually called Cancer Alley because of high incidence of cancers in that area. It is also one of the leading production centers for chemicals. Are those companies improving their performance? Not as high as one would want. Certainly there are a lot of questions about the kind of emissions from those plants themselves. You mentioned Chevron. I think it's a good example. It's a California example. And, there's been a long struggle there to of the neighborhoods there to protect themselves against the kind of emissions and hazards of the Chevron plant. And you're right. I was in Richmond only recently and had a chance to talk to the new mayor there, an architect, who basically is trying to create a better response to Chevron's kind of arguments. And it is important that there be that pressure as well. But that pressure is a lot about emissions and wastes. And it's a hard argument to get from there to, well, let's change the chemistry itself. We did that here in Massachusetts by passing a law now 25 years ago called the Toxics Use Reduction Act, which requires that all plants in Massachusetts, including any plant the size of Chevron or whatever, has to do plans on how they would reduce or eliminate the use of hazardous chemicals in their production operations. And that has been a pretty successful law here.
Well, and let's properly credit that you are one of the authors, or were one of the authors of that law, and served as the director of the Massachusetts Toxic Use Reduction Institute for 13 years. So you can toot that horn.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I'm pretty proud of the work of that program, and I think we've shown here in Massachusetts, certainly not a state as large as California or anything like that, but we've shown here in Massachusetts that you really can work to create an environment in which firms are really moving towards safer chemicals. We've reduced the use of a list of about 95 chemicals. We've reduced the use by 40% here in Massachusetts. We've reduced the production of hazardous waste by about 67%. So it's a good example. But that's required both a kind of a regulatory response, but also a lot of working with the firms themselves.
Mm-hmm.
California has a new law, consumer product regulatory law, which I also worked on, I was one of the co-chairs of the science board that helped to develop the regulations for that. And that law requires that the state agency to identify a certain number of products each year. And if a company manufactures those products, they need to do what I talked about earlier, an alternatives assessment, to identify whether there are safer alternatives and to use those safer alternatives as effective and cost effective. We're just seeing that come into effect now. We don't know what the effects of that law are going to be, but it's a good start in California there as well.
Dr. Geiser, when I read your section about Norco and I was thinking about Richmond, the term that came to mind was coined by Chris Hedges in a book a few years ago. He refers to these areas, which are predominantly impoverished communities of color that are often the sites of these huge industrial facilities, as capitalism's sacrifice zones. Are you familiar with that tag, and how do you respond to that? Did the industries get there first, and that was simply a cheap neighborhood where people could live? Or did the, you know, where was the chicken and egg in this cycle? Because it is an obvious pattern that many of these facilities are located in ghettos or very poor communities of color.
Well, there's a fairly robust argument about that question, whether firms actually located in low-income and minority communities, or whether those communities became low-income and minority because the housing values fell and it was the one place people with limited means could afford. But, you know, honestly, Peter, I'm not sure that it actually matters as much. The point is, and the really fact is, that the neighborhoods of many of the most hazardous production facilities in the country are populated by low-income people, people of color, minority folks, people, disabled people who have limited means. And it's very hard to justify the fact that people who have the limited capacity that they do should live near really hazardous facilities. There are groups organized through the environmental justice community or in general environmental justice movement that are working on that. I work with a group called Coming Clean, which is a coalition of many groups around the country that are trying to work on safer chemicals. It includes a very strong environmental justice component that needs to be more developed. I think we as a nation have never taken it as seriously as we should, but I think we need to note that the people who are often at most risks are workers in these plants and the people who live next to them.
Mm-hmm. Your book is not about Monsanto. There are a couple of references to it, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about this huge company that has dominated the pesticide industry. And from there, it went on to try to corner the market on seed stocks. And with its glyphosate product Roundup and Roundup Ready seeds that Monsanto has developed, you know, they claim that this is the solution to world hunger, and that this can, you know, allow for huge increases in crop productivity. But I know many people are deeply concerned. And here, for example, where I live in Marin County, we have succeeded in banning the use of glyphosate on the watershed for weed control. These are the hills and you know, small mountains that dot our landscape. And the water that flows from that is the water that we use to drink and bathe with. And so if you would, please give me your characterization of Monsanto and the risk that we face by its kind of hardline capitalist management of seeds and pesticides in ways that I find, frankly, alarming.
Well, Monsanto's an interesting company. You're right. It took on very early, realized that the profits were going to be higher in the life sciences area than they were in the traditional chemicals area. They sold off their chemical industry to create a new company that manages the chemical side of what was Monsanto's work. They moved into this pesticide and seed nexus, and I think it's important to note it's a nexus. It has to do with the marketing of pesticides and the marketing of, and here we talk about genetically modified seeds, because of course that's the other product here, because it wasn't possible to patent seeds, naturally occurring seeds, but it was possible to patent and own genetically modified seeds. So Monsanto created a very interesting business model, you might say, from in which the sales of those seeds and the sales of glyphosates co-evolve into a system that they have guarded very heavily. They've taken very extreme measures to protect that relationship, including suing farmers that use seeds that have been diffused from nearby farms. As you mentioned, the glyphosates are the herbicide that is used to sort of cut down any competitors to a crop that uses a Monsanto-based seed. Glyphosates, Monsanto claims, have a very short active life and that they degrade in the environment. On the other hand, there's other studies that suggest that's very optimistic and that the bioactive components of a glyphosate may exist months after it's supposed to. So it's an example of the kind of business thinking that does not really think about the protection of the environment and health in the way that I'm trying to advocate in the book.
Do you support labeling for GMO products?
Yes, I do. I think that I support labeling in general, but mm-hmm. yes, we have no other way for consumers to actually be able to shop wisely if we actually think that's what consumers should be doing. Consumers need to know what is in a product, and I think that's true of whether it's a carcinogen or a reproductive hazard or whether it's a genetically modified chemical or life form. So, yes, labeling is really important.
Professor, there are many things in your book, and I want to recommend it to people who have any interest in the topic of chemicals and your vision of the development of less toxic, less dangerous, green-style chemicals as we go forward. And one, just a two-paragraph item that you include in the book is what you call life cycle assessment. And the idea of pricing products based on their full life cycle and not just the immediate use of a consumer or anyone else who buys and uses that product is something that I think is pretty important to reflect the true cost of the development, use, and safe destruction or putting out to pasture, I don't know the right term, the degradation process of some chemicals that have a longer lifespan. Talk a little bit about this, and do you see ways to persuade the corporate interests to embrace an end-to-end pricing model so that we don't end up with landfills that are, bursting with illegally dumped toxic chemicals?
Yes, the life cycle thinking starts with life cycle thinking. You've got the right idea. Life cycle thinking really is taking a look at the life of a chemical or a product, for that matter, from its initial manufacture and inception all the way through its distribution, its working its way through the economy, its use, and eventually to its recycling or disposal. It's that chemical in that product is the same chemical throughout that period of time. And it's sort of generally true. In some cases, they actually transform, but it is the legacy of that chemical in that case. The way we set prices on products is we take a portion of that. We take the cost of producing something, the cost of manufacturing the product, and the cost of selling it, and consider that to be the price. But because we don't attend to all the other life cycle stages and all of the costs along the life cycle, that is, the cost to the environment of pollution during manufacture, the cost to workers of potentially damaged health, the cost to distribution in the sense of cost of energy necessary to transport products, and then take a look at all of the costs that occur after the product is used in terms of managing the wastes often borne by municipal governments and to the environment and to health as those wastes are dumped or released as into waterways or whatever. And are essentially become part of the environment and potentially jeopardize components of the environment. And so what we have is prices built on only a select part of the life cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And all the other costs are, as it's talked about, externalized from the production.
That's dumping. That's dumping them on somebody else.
That's right.
Let me take that.
Your question is yes, it would be good if we could internalize those prices and make the price of a product bear the true cost, such that firms really are responsible for the chemical all the way through. You ask, is this going to be easy to do? No, this is going to be very heavily resisted. I only note it as one possible vehicle along the line of many others. But yeah, it is a good effort. The Europeans tend to use taxes more as a way, taxes on corporations, taxes on products, taxes on value added, as a means of trying to incorporate some of these prices into a product. In this environment, in this country, it's going to be hard to do that.
So, Professor, before we started recording, I mentioned that my bias toward your whole field of work is that I have the deepest knowledge on the catastrophic events and the long-term side effects that are often not acknowledged by these industries, as we're just discussing here, and they externalize those costs. So most recently, we have the self-inflicted wound to Flint, Michigan, where in order to save a few bucks, and they disconnected from the more expensive Detroit waterworks system and forced people to drink water from the Flint River. And now the lead contamination has reached an epidemic level in Flint, Michigan. We have the long-running issues with asbestos. We had just a year and a half ago the West Virginia River that was flooded with toxic chemicals from a spill, probably related to illegal dumping or some sort of cost-cutting on the safety side. This past summer, the EPA itself was responsible for the toxic waste pond in Colorado. And as they attempted to deal with it, they ended up opening up a floodgate and allowing that to flow into the Colorado River. We've got the blowout, the Shell blowout in the Gulf of Mexico, and the dispersants that were used to try to break up the oil globs that may have unintended side effects of their own. There is fracking. There are bomb trains, the oil trains with the tar sands extracted product that's being brought in from Canada and from the North Slope of the United States. We talked a little bit about Monsanto and glyphosate. So the, you know, knowledge that most people have is to be afraid of chemicals and not to trust the corporations that profit from their exploitation, extraction, processing, and distribution. So how do we reconcile the sorry track record of the industry, particularly in recent years, with the lack of any desire to further regulate them by Washington or state-level governments? And this leaves consumers really with limited information, but at the mercy of a government that is compromised by the industries that that dominate the distribution of these chemical-based products.
Well, you list out quite a litany of examples of kind of...
That's just what came to mind while I was reading your book.
Yeah. you're very good on that. And yes, you paint the picture that is the very worrisome picture that lies behind this whole area of work. And one can be overwhelmed by that and frightened and lose hope because of the kind of conditions that you meant. This is all part of what I consider the risk-based model of using hazardous chemicals, but trying to regulate them, trying to set standards, trying to control their exposure from them, etc. And what I'm trying to say in the book is our efforts to do that at that level are going to always be compromised by the kinds of errors and mismanagement and whatever you want to call it, malfeasance that you list. Instead, I try to suggest that while it's certainly a long, long haul, we should be moving to a safer system of chemicals, because if we were using safer chemicals, then the release and the accidental exposures and all to chemistry would be less lethal and less dangerous. The long haul is really to create a greener and more sustainable chemical market, such that we don't have to constantly worry about these chemistries. It sounds a bit Pollyannish and, say, futuristic, but that is ultimately the solution, and we need to marshal ourselves onto the big effort of really converting to a safer system of chemicals.
The book is Chemicals Without Harm, Policies for a Sustainable World. We've been talking with Ken Geiser, G-E-I-S-E-R, and he is Professor Emeritus of Work Environment at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, and the founder and past coordinator, or co-director, of the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production. Thank you very much for joining me today, Professor.
Thank you, Peter, for a great interview, and I've enjoyed it.
Thanks to Del Leonard for inspiring this interview. I'd appreciate your comments and feedback. My email is peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.